on our docket this morning is 51423, Fernandez versus Fernandez. Counsel, are we ready on this one? All right, we'll give Mr. Woodbury a minute to pack up.
Your Honor, Radford Smith on behalf of the appellant Anthony Fernandez. Your Honor, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Since the time of the adjudication of this action, the court has entered a ruling that I think is probably going to be the focus of today's discussion because it essentially changed some of the criteria that I think we were all operating at the time that this decision was made. The case involves an individual who is now obligated to pay $4,000 per month in child support but earns $3,000 per month. The court made the specific finding that his child support obligation under the application of statute of employment would be zero, instead upheld a waiver outlined in a series of stipulations, well, actually one stipulation that was entered in the year 1999. The findings of the court does not contain any examination of the best interests of the children, nor does it contain any statutory criteria. With the waiver argument, the Rivero 2 decision issued by this court on August 27th of this year seems to stand for the principle that the parties can agree to anything, at least in the context there of child custody matters. But that when the court is required to review those child custody matters, then the court must apply the law, that is, under Nevada statute. I can't imagine any reason why that criteria would not apply to child support action. I think the same attempt in the Rivero case to give us some uniform guidelines as to child custody are certainly present and have been present in the statute since 1986 when this formula arose. I have offered some insights as to, we've been doing this a long time, this formula, I don't think, as I indicated in my supplemental authorities, I can't recall a single experience where a judge has failed or even considered best interests of the children as part of the application of the statutory formula. Instead, the courts uniformly address the criteria.
Well, counsel, as we start parsing through Rivero and where it's going to take us, and it's your interpretation that we're mandated, or we're at first blush reviewing a voluntary agreement between the parties to then have to fall back to the formula. In this situation, we have a court reviewing it. The assertion was a change in circumstance. The court reviewed it, but the court indicated that even though the income had declined, there were still sufficient assets available. That seems to be my understanding of what was in front of the court. There's some other things, but that's the opening blush.
Yeah, well, in addition to the fact that it was more than 3 years since Sophie was entitled to, and that gets us back into the idea of whether or not at that three-year period we're required to apply the formula. But answering your question,
which gets us into a whole interesting, because the underpinnings of this, again, it was a voluntary agreement by both parties. Both parties got and gave up certain things, which still creates a problem in the aftermath of Rivero as to this bargain for agreement, so to speak.
Well, it may. Let me address that under two ways. One is the criteria or factual statements that were contained in the appellant's reply or respondent's reply brief really were never part of this court's adjudication of this particular issue. In other words, the court didn't find he had received so much consideration that it was not going to allow this. The court simply found that an agreement is an agreement, and therefore he's waived his right to modification. And there's sort of a subtle distinction there. The distinction is that I receive a bunch of stuff in exchange for this bargain versus I waive the right to modify. Those are two different distinctions. She never made any finding, the court never made any finding on whether or not he had received so much that it was unjust. And as I point out in my reply brief, that statement is just simply not upheld by the record. The record shows that the specific consideration that he received for this particular waiver was the consideration that then the court found was not going to apply, the fact that she would not request to move outside the state of Nevada. So he never got the consideration he requested. This notion that he lowered alimony, et cetera, is not upheld by the record because, first, when she went in and tried to modify the changes or the exchange of property in the original divorce decree, the judge already ruled on that, found that there was no basis to do so, and denied her motion. In the second blush, she argues that, well, she lowered her alimony. But we see that there were two separate stipulations. The first stipulation,
for argument's sake, if we were to take those things off the table and only put back on the table this consideration of the child staying in Nevada, would your position still be the same?
No, because I don't think we should allow parties to start bargaining child support. And that's really what this is about, is whether or not we're going to say we're going to require them to apply the statutory formula as is required by the formula itself. The formula states that in every order the court issues, it must clearly state that this order complies with the statutory formula. Implicit in that direct, unequivocal statement is that even when parties agree, they must state that it complies because the courts or the legislature wanted it to comply. It wanted a consistent mathematical formula that people can be free to understand what their obligations are and bargain in good faith over child support. If you looked at the Wisconsin decision that I cited in our opening brief, the Wisconsin court rejected this notion of people bargaining. And the quote from that case that I think is most applicable here is that the party should find other methods to negotiate property issues other than child support. Doesn't that make sense in a system that's designed to give us consistent awards that does not play with the rights of the children to have their statutory criteria met?
But the judge isn't precluded from deviating from the formula and adjusting it in any manner it sees fit as long as it makes particular findings.
Well, that's not true. It's true in the sense that it can make particular findings, but it must be findings consistent with the statutory criteria. If we say that the judge can use any criteria, then that abrogates the court's duty to look for the criteria that are in NRS 125B09. Those 12 criteria, the only criteria, this court has recognized that in the Rivera decision, are the only criteria, the Caldy decision, the Anastasis decision, et cetera, are the only criteria that the court can use. And so if we start allowing other criteria, like you parties agreed to something else, we've changed the formula. And that's what Mr. Fernandez does not want to see happen.
But in this particular instance, had the judge applied case law that you would have found based upon the custody, there would have been a zero net child support, right? Zero on each side.
The court made that specific finding in its plea. We don't have to guess on that. And that's why, when I indicated to Justice Douglas, all these arguments about what she considered or not considered in terms of the bargain for rights, that's subsumed by the finding that if she was going to apply the formula, if the district court was going to apply the formula, it would have been zero, period. And then under the statutory criteria, it's argued on the supplement that because the view of Parkinson changed, that somehow that abrogated his right. It didn't, because we only argued Parkinson as sort of an aside. He had 3 years of criteria, clearly that. But the interesting part about the court's Rivera decision is what happens after that three-year period. Are we now going to state that there's some other criteria other than the statute upon which the court can deviate from the formula, such as just a wide-open view of best interest of the child? That's something I think the court needs to address more for remand, but for this particular appeal, it does not have to address because we already know how the court ruled on the various factors. It did not.
Is your argument really that under 125B145, an agreement that waives child support is only good for the 3-year term because after the 3 years expires and the parent requests review, you're saying that the statutory factors then are mandatorily followed without regard to the fact that the parties voluntarily agreed to waive child support.
Yes, because that's what the statute says.
So you find that in 125B145,
yes,
in its must language.
And in 125B080, which says that upon review, the court must, shall apply the statutory formula. In 125B145, how the court has interpreted it in Rivero is that it has a two-step process before ever getting to the formula. One of those is the best interests of the child. The other is an application of the factors that normally would stand to vary the formula as a basis for applying it. And I've indicated and opined in my supplemental authorities that that's going to undermine the very function of how this formula has worked for the last so many years. But again, you don't need to come to those conclusions in order to resolve this appeal. Because the question is whether the real question I think is presented by the waiver is, can parties prospectively waive any right to modify? Can they do that? In other words, can they abrogate the entirety of the statutory formula? This would be an easy conversation if they had abrogated the formula downward, wouldn't it? It wouldn't even be a close call, because if they had abrogated to the point where the children couldn't meet the criteria necessary to meet their needs, for example, then clearly that doesn't make sense to apply the waiver in that circumstance. Well, then why does it make sense just because the waiver offered a different amount? That's the argument of the respondent, that, well, if it's over the statutory amount, they can waive all they want. But if it's under, no, they can't do that. There's nothing about this court's precedent to say that. There's the decision I cited.
Well, the best interest of the child, theoretically, that's what they offer as the rationale for distinguishing between a waiver upwards or downwards. But whether that's supportable under the statute or not is another question.
Well, perhaps. In this case, you could argue that, but that's not what the court found. In other words, the court never went into the best interest analysis. I think this appeal is really simple in its core, in that now that we found that there can be a revision of any kind of agreement of the parties based upon an application of the statutory law, and now that there are really criteria that are very different, I think, in practical application than were in existence at the time, I think that this matter stands for the proposition that if the court had those criteria, it must enter an order consistent with those criteria. And here it did not. There's not even anything close to that in this.
So record. You're really arguing for a remand under Rivero?
Well, I think that you don't need to remand it, because we know what would happen upon remand, because the court has already indicated. The only possible way it could find that there wasn't a reasonable basis for a modification of support. I think I'm out of time.
So you have 3 minutes, but
I've reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal. I'm going to need it. Thank you.
Morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Robert Eisenberg appearing with Edward Kanan on behalf of the respondent. When these parties got divorced, Anthony got the Lamborghini, the Ferrari, the Mercedes, the Explorer, the 8,000-square-foot house, the joint investment account, and three of the businesses that the couple owned. Jennifer got one car, her personal bank account, some furniture, and some other items. But more important to her was what she received from Anthony was a commitment that he would pay alimony and child support for their two boys. In 1999, there was a stipulation in which the parties agreed that the alimony would expire in 2 years. $5,000 a month, the alimony would expire. And in exchange for that, the child support went up $1,000 a month to $4,000 a month. And then in 2000, and by the way, that 1999 stipulation, Anthony was represented by Attorney Jim Jimerson, who drafted the agreement. Then in 2000, Anthony's also represented by Mr. Jimerson, who drafts another stipulation. And this one says that there's some modifications to the custody arrangement, but the main thing is the parties agree that neither one of them will seek to modify the alimony provision that was about to expire in a year or the child support provision. Neither one of them will do that. Very important to Anthony. Why? Because he's making millions of dollars a year at that time. Very important to him and his lawyer, Mr. Jemerson, because they want to make sure that Jennifer doesn't do anything to increase the alimony. So she lives with it for 7 years. She complies with her part of the bargain until she makes a motion in the district court to resolve an issue that they were having involving medical care of one of the boys. And Anthony retaliates with a motion to reduce his child support obligation. We contend that under this situation, the district court was well within its discretion in upholding the agreement of the parties and determining that there had not been a sufficient change of circumstances. There are really three independent grounds on which you can affirm this judgment. First, you can determine that there was part performance by the parties or estoppel, that after all these years, Anthony simply cannot come to court and get the court to modify this agreement. Second,
are you taking the position that this cannot be modified, period? That the parties can't come in under changed circumstances if they show it and ask for modification?
Well, this, our second ground that I was going to mention is the waiver itself, that he's bound by it unless he can show under the Rivero case that there's some legal ground to set it aside. And the court in that case said, for example, unconscionability, other traditional contract principles, perhaps impossibility of performance. And the third ground would be that he did not show change of circumstances sufficient to modify the child support arrangement here. And that kind of goes into a question that Justice Perrigari asked earlier. And Justice Perrigari, you suggested that you felt that the district court had held that there was basically that under the circumstances here, if you applied the statutory formula, that there would be no support. And the counsel agreed with you, but that's not really what the district judge found. The district judge found that if Anthony's allegations were true, then there might be a wash on it. And what the district judge referred to was Anthony's allegations. The judge said that Anthony presents evidence that his income has fallen, that he represents that his present income is lower, that he alleges financial setbacks. And then the judge said, based on each party's purported current income, then neither party would be obligated to pay support to the other. So she never really found that there was, in fact, a change of circumstances. We believe the Rivero case is directly on point now, and even the dissent in Rivero would support our position here, because everybody in Rivero, all of the justices, concurred that the district judge, number one, does have discretion, and number two, that there has to be a change of circumstances and that those circumstances have to be changed to the effect that they influence the welfare of the children. And in fact, there has to be two things, that the reduction of child support in this case would be in the best interest of the children and that it's a result of changed circumstances. And Anthony didn't prove either of those in this case. As far as the agreement itself here, we also believe Rivero covers that situation as well. And again, I don't recall the dissent having any disagreement with the majority holding, where the majority said, quote, parties are free to contract, and courts will enforce their contracts if they are not unconscionable, illegal, or in violation of public policy. There's certainly nothing unconscionable about this agreement. Mr. Jemerson drafted on behalf of Anthony. They're the ones who wanted it. Anthony's the one who got the benefit of it for all those years when he was making millions of dollars, and when Jennifer was complying with her part of the bargain and not moving to reinstate the alimony that had been taken away and moving to increase the child support when he was making millions of dollars. So there's certainly no unconscionability. There's no illegality involved. and whether there's some kind of public policy, how could you argue that it's a violation of public policy to deny a father's motion to reduce child support in situations where the district court found that he does, in fact, have the assets and the income to meet his complete obligation, and in a situation where the mother has relied on it for 7 years? How could that possibly be a violation of public policy?
In that analysis, is it your belief then that we don't, if there's no showing of change of circumstance, we never get to any considerations of child's best interest?
Well, I'm not sure which comes first, and I'm not sure it matters which comes first, because if either one of those two is missing, then there's no modification. At least that's the way I read Rivera. But there has to be both. In this case, the district judge did not specifically say that her ruling was in the best interest of the child. But certainly, nobody could argue that that wasn't what she was thinking. I mean, that permeated the whole record here. And the change of circumstances, she found that even if his allegations are true, that his income went down, that the circumstances weren't changed enough to justify a modification of the custody, because he still had $1 million, and even if $1 million net worth, plus income from his job, and even if he paid his entire child support obligation, he would still have $800,000 left over. So that's like, you know, if I made $10 million, if somebody made $10 million a year, and then his income went down to $9 million a year, he's going to be able to come to court and say, gee, I've changed circumstances because I'm making $1 million a year less than I used to make. Well, of course not, because he's still making $9 million a year.
That's just something I want to clear up. His income was $1 million, or that was his corpus of assets?
His net worth of his assets. And what Anthony argued in the district court and has argued here is that assets are irrelevant. You should only look to income. Well, our response to that would be you just cannot interpret the statutory scheme to be that absurd. You can't allow a situation where maybe somebody has $1 million in the drawer of their dresser at home, but they're claiming, well, I only have a job that pays me $30,000 a year, so judge, you have to ignore my $1 million and only base this on my income. There's really no justification for that. And especially when you're talking about somebody who's asking for a modification of child support and a reduction of child support, coupled with the fact that he agreed to it. And he agreed to it because it benefited him, and it did benefit him for 7 years, more than 7 years, really. In response to Justice Pickering's question, counsel said that he believes, if I understand his answer correctly, that he believes that when the parties enter into an agreement, after 3 years, the agreement's out, and you start from scratch under the statute. I'm not aware of any statute or case law that supports that. In fact, what Rivera says is that you do have the right to review after 3 years, but you don't have the right to modification. So when you get to court, you get the review, but you still have to show that that the modification, or in this case the reduction, is in the best interest of the child, and that there's a change in circumstances that would affect the welfare of the children. And so there's nothing in Rivera that says you just throw out the agreement after 3 years. If that were the law, certainly the court in Rivera would have applied it that way. And there's nothing in that opinion that suggests that.
What do you make of his Wisconsin case that he articulates from it a public policy against allowing people to use child support as, in essence, a bargaining tool? That's his argument on the public policy issue, as I understand it. And I may not be doing it justice, but...
Well, I have two responses to that. First, as I recall the Wisconsin case, it was a situation where the parties, it involved a reduction of child support. The party wanted to increase the child support. And the court said, well, you can't have an agreement that prevents child support from being increased to a level that would meet the needs of the children, because otherwise parents would just act in their own best interests and would ignore the interests of their children, or they could.
Or potentially calamitous health issue arises or something of that nature.
And we don't have that situation here. But the other response I wanted to make, I find it interesting that counsel says that parties should not be allowed to bargain child support with other things. Well, that's exactly what happened here. And who was it who asked for that bargain? It was Anthony and his lawyer, Mr. Jemison. They're the ones who wanted to make sure that Jennifer couldn't increase the child support. They're the ones who bargained away the right to modify that. They're the ones who asked for the provision saying that if Jennifer ever moves, files a motion in the district court to move the child out of state, then that's consideration for the child support modification waiver. So they're the ones who asked for all that. And yet now they take the position that, well, the parties shouldn't be able to bargain like that. And that's exactly what they did. And maybe in another case, the court might be faced with a better issue to resolve something like that, to resolve whether there's public policy reasons why parties shouldn't be able to bargain this kind of
thing. Does the fact that district court struck the non-relocation aspect affect anything?
Well, our position is no. She shouldn't have done that in the first place. It was a complete sua sponte ruling, no briefing by the parties. Arguably, it violated the due process rights of both parties here. And as I said in my brief, we believe the correct remedy, if any, here, is for this court to strike that out of the order and say, no, it's not ripe, it wasn't ripe at that time, and someday, if Jennifer ever does move to relocate with the children, then it will be ripe, and then the court will have to decide whether it violates public policy. But it shouldn't have any effect here.
So your position is Jennifer has provided the full consideration, it's intact, and she continues to provide it?
She has.
Yeah.
She agreed that she would never move to relocate with the children out of state, and she never has. That was the consideration that's in the stipulation. And that's where the judge reached out and struck it. In conclusion, I would just point out that the public policy of Nevada and Nevada statutes of supporting children, making sure they have adequate levels of support, and allowing parents to agree, allowing parents to enter into contracts, particularly when they're represented by able counsel, those policies simply are not offended by the judge's decision here. Nothing in this record shows an abuse of discretion or a violation of Nevada law or any inherent unfairness or injustice. The decision here was correct and should be upheld. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg. Mr. Smith, you've got about 3 minutes.
Again, we're starting with sort of an emotional argument about what Anthony received and didn't receive or what Jennifer received. He didn't mention the fact that Jennifer received a home that was worth over $1 million, the fact that they were married 3 years, that's all, the fact that most of these assets were on far before the marriage, but none of that was mentioned. It's just this idea that he received all these things. Nothing is also mentioned about the fact that in the year that the stipulation was made, he made $4.8 million. 2 years later, he lost $3.1 million and continued to lose money until the time that he finally came to court and asked. But nothing is said in the record about the fact that this $1 million worth of assets is the same amount of assets that's held by Jennifer, and that $3,000 of the $4,000 he pays for her goes into a savings account. Moreover, the monies nothing is mentioned about the monies he pays, $15,000 per year per child, for a school that he's required to pay that is not part of any stipulation that where he agreed that that would be non-modifiable. And the court has simply found that that's not a variation from the statutory child support formula. That makes no sense to say that you must pay for the children's education because you agreed to it in a stipulation that was not something where you waived modification of that stipulation. And now your income is such that it's lower than that $6,000 higher per year than the amount you'll pay for your children's schooling, and that doesn't include the $48,000 per year that you need to pay in child support. I don't think the equities in this matter are anywhere favorable to Jennifer. In terms of this idea that she waived something, she waived nothing. She had received spousal support for several years after a three-year marriage. This notion that it was Mr. Jimerson's idea, I don't know that why we bring up Mr. Jimerson, is if it somehow gives some imprimatur of reasonableness. Mr. Jimerson was representing one side. She had counsel, too. They reached on a bargain. Now, the question before the court is whether or not that bargain is going to prospectively waive support. So this court has to find that they prospectively waive support. The court's never found that. In Parkinson, it only said that it could retroactively find that a party that came to court would be able to waive the retroactive application of the amount of child support. Mr. Fernandez is not doing that. He's current in his child support. The question is, does it make sense for us to develop a criteria that says that parties can negotiate child support as part of property settlement payments? That shouldn't be allowed. That wasn't what happened in this case. What he negotiated for was the very thing that Justice Perry-Gear had asked about, and that is he didn't want this notion that she could just move out of state with the children. I also note that he bargained for other things in these stipulations. For example, he bargained that if she cohabitated with a man, that the amount of time that he would have with the children would increase. Yet when they went to court in 2004, Judge threw that out.
Go ahead, finish your thought.
Judge threw that out as well. He hasn't received any of the benefit of his bargain on the criteria that set forth in those obligations. And again, Your Honor, this might be one that we could talk about for a long, long time, but I hope you review the briefs. I would just note that the Wisconsin case did not, you'll review those cases, that did not indicate what I think that he was thinking about the initial case. There were other cases later on that stood for the proposition where parties seeking a reduction in support, those same principles were correct. Thank you.
All right, counsel, thanks so much for your good briefs and the good arguments, and this case will stand submitted. The court will stand in recess.